Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc Forum called Which Path for Patent Challenges? The USPTO's One Challenge NPRM for Interparties Review. We're very pleased to welcome our moderator, Robert Randa, who is a partner at Patrick Doerr, where he brings over three decades of experience in intellectual property law. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I would note, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Mr. Randa, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Sarah. I'd also like to thank the Federalist Society for the opportunity to participate as the moderator of what will undoubtedly be an informative and insightful discussion about the recent USPTO Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, or NPRM, changes to Institution of Interparties Review, or IPR, before the PTAB. I now have the distinct honor and privilege to introduce our panelists. In the interest of time, I will keep these introductions brief, as you would see from their extended bios that are available everywhere bios are available. Each panelist is so accomplished that their full bios would fill a large part of the hour. So first we have Andre Iancu. Andre is a former Undersecretary of Commerce for Intellectual Property and Director of U.S. Patent and Trademark Office during President Trump's first term in office. He is currently a partner at Sullivan & Cromwell and one of the leading voices in intellectual property law and innovation policy. Next, we have David W. Jones. David is the Executive Director of High Tech Inventors Alliance, or HTIA. Prior to HTIA, David was Assistant General Counsel for Patent Policy at Microsoft. Prior to that, he held multiple positions on Capitol Hill. He also clerked for the former Chief Judge Sharon Prost on the Federal Circuit and Judge Will Garwood on the Fifth Circuit. Next, we have Joseph Mittal. Joseph is the principal at Clear IP LLC. He has served as both the USPTO acting director and acting solicitor. Prior to that, he served in a senior legal roles for more than a decade for the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. And in that capacity, he negotiated and drafted many of the key provisions of the American Invents Act. And next, we have Brian O'Shaughnessy. Brian is a partner at Dinsmore and Scholl LLP, the chair of Dinsmore IP Transaction and Licensing Group. He has extensive experience in contested proceedings before the PTAB. He has also been retained as a testifying witness in IP and licensing disputes by the U.S. Department of Justice, U.S. Department of Treasury, and by various private enterprises. Now, before we delve into the four specific categories of the NPRM, which are: one, required stipulation for efficiency; two, claims found invalid in prior proceedings; three, parallel litigation; and four, institution in extraordinary circumstances, I would like to invite each of our speakers to provide opening remarks outlining their view of the NPRM. We will then move on to a discussion among the panelists. Director Iancu, if you could please lead us off.
Sure. Thanks, Rob, and great to be with all the panelists and all the Federal Society folks watching this. Look, the main point about the NPRM is that the office is taking steps to go through the notice and comment process to solicit views from the public. And then make the appropriate final policy decisions, presumably taking into account the views from the public. And there are multiple points to the NPRM, and I'm sure we're going to touch on all of them during the panel discussion. But the key concept here seems to be an effort to align the IPR process with two core principles. One, to have a single bite at the apple at the invalidity stage or in the invalidity analysis during an infringement case, and to give meaning to the original concept of the IPR system to be a faster alternative to district court litigation. So they're trying to, at least conceptually, to reduce or eliminate multiple attacks on the same, on the validity of the same patent, and to effectively eliminate IPRs if they're not in fact faster than the parallel district court litigation. Whether the NPRM actually achieves those, in a precise, in a perfectly balanced manner, or whether you think those requirements are good or bad for the patent system, that's obviously to be debated, and we'll have to see what the public say. One thing I'm sure of is that the PTO will get a very significant number of comments, just judging by the comments the PTO got on prior such requests for public input on PTAB policies. So I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you, Andre. Mr. Jones, please provide your overview of the NPRM.
I think it's a mess. Let me just make three quick points. First, it's contrary to statute. I mean, a lot of these things Congress considered and specifically rejected, and hopefully Joe will talk a little bit about that. I was the Republican staffer who kind of started off the patent reform process in the Senate, and Joe was the superstar who carried it over the finish line. The second problem with it, the regs just don't make any sense. I mean, they're going to lead to all sorts of arbitrary results. They foreclose IPRs based on non-final decisions, for example, right? And so you can have all sorts of situations where you have an initial determination by the ITC that is eventually overruled by the full commission, or a district court summary judgment kind of decision saying that, you know, that this is found not invalid under 103, that gets reversed by the federal circuit, right? And it'll be years in between. So you're going to have situations where you have like a period of time where everyone is foreclosed from challenging the patent. And by the time the window opens again, because the incorrect decision, you know, from the district court gets overruled, well, most of those petitioners, maybe all of them, are going to be time barred because they're defendants in a lawsuit. You know, they've already been sued on the patent. So it basically gives the patent owner free reign for a long period of time, you know, usually 3 years, I think, for a federal circuit decision to assert the patent without any fear of an IPR. And it's, you know, people call this a one and done type of approach. It, in many cases, will be a zero and done type approach, just for exactly those reasons. Another problem I'd point out is all of these provisions say that an IPR shall not be instituted or maintained, right? So that presumably means that if you're, you know, post final written decision and pre director review, right? So you already have a decision, but it's not final yet. If any of the things that, you know, in the second and third part of the regs happen, which includes the PTO just deciding it's more likely than not that something will happen in the future, then you lose the ability, like basically they will dismiss the IPR. And then you have already signed a stipulation saying you can't challenge under 102 or 103. In that scenario, that petitioner not only doesn't get the benefit of IPR, also can't challenge it in court, assuming the stipulation is deemed valid. So and that's like three examples out of thousands, I think, were the real problems. And I say the last thing, and this kind of actually surprised me, the NPRM does not do almost anything to support the PTO's conclusions or proposals with actual evidence or data. I mean, the handful of things that they cite, you know, I went through them, all their sources, and half of them don't seem to support the contention the PTO is making in the first place. But they have all sorts of factual contentions like, oh, this will save litigation costs. Well, we've got economic studies out there that already talk about how much litigation cost IPR has saved. You're going to forfeit that. I don't know how the PTO gets the idea that, oh, you know, on balance, you're going to save litigation costs. Or they say that, stronger patent systems, will address market concentration. Well, there are a bunch of academic papers from economists saying the opposite, that patents are correlated with market concentration, not vice versa. So it really is unsupported. They use kind of skewed statistics. And that surprised me, because it seems like that might be a basis for challenge down the road, assuming there is any ability to challenge under the APA.
Thank you, David. Mr. O'Shaughnessy.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah. Well, I'll echo the comments. I'm very pleased to be here amongst this distinguished panel, and it's a real honor to be here. So thanks to the FedSoc for providing this forum. David raises some issues that are worthy of consideration, and I'm sure that those will find their way into his comments that he provides in this response to notice to proposed rulemaking. And that's the purpose of this webinar, but it's also the purpose of the NPRM, is to hear from the practitioners about how the proposed rules might actually be put into practical effect. I think personally that the proposed rules make a lot of sense. They bring a lot of balance. They bring a lot of corrective measures, if you will, to the way that the IPR system has been implemented. We all know that the AIA had as one of its objective to bring greater reliability and transparency to the patent system and to give people an alternative to litigation. We also know that the IPR process is one of only three post-grant processes available to challengers at the PTO. And of course, there are the courts and the ITC. So there are plenty of avenues by which challengers can go after a particular patent. And I think, they have the opportunity to file PGRs, for example, early on. PGRs are properly time-barred. They give the patent owner, if we had only PGRs, we'd probably be better off. They give the patent owner the opportunity to rely on quiet title to their asset. And so there are lots of things that we need to do to remedy the current situation, because quite frankly, the IPRs haven't been an alternative to litigation. They've been an adjunct to litigation. And this has, in fact, only raised expense. It's delayed the decision to a final decision on the validity of a particular patent. And this has worked to enormous detriment to our innovation economy. So I disagree with Dave that, patents don't really do the system any good. I think the patents have been shown to be enormously beneficial, particularly to the disruptive innovator who doesn't have the assets and the resources that the incumbents have. So I think bringing some balance, looking at the IPR system in terms of how it affects the actual patent owners and particularly the innovators is well placed. And these rules make a lot of sense and I think bring a lot more balance back into the program.
Thank you, Brian. Mr. Mattel, please round it out with your views.
Thank you. It's kind of hard to take the NPRM seriously. It's basically a set of arbitrary restrictions that are designed to cut off access to review, including for people who are being sued. The most problematic rule is the one and done rule, that if anyone in any forum has ever challenged the patent, then you can't challenge it if you're sued a decade later. Even if you never knew about the previous suit, the previous challenge can even be in the ITC. ITC proceedings don't create estoppel against later enforcement of the patent, even if they find the patent invalid. They include ex parte re-examine, which parties can't even participate once the proceeding has started. But most fundamentally, there's this old Anglo-American principle that if you're sued, you're allowed to present your own defense. It was in 2008 in the Sturgill case that the Supreme Court rejected the concept of virtual representation, that you don't have the right to present your own defense because somebody else represented you somewhere else. Another key feature of the rules is this timing with district court litigation, that if the district court's going to get to trial faster, we should cut off review. Principally, that means if you're sued in East Texas, where the average time to trial is in about 16 months, then you don't have the right to challenge the patent at the board. Again, even if you're being sued on it by someone demanding millions. And about 90% of the litigation in East Texas is NPE litigation. Why on earth we would privilege that, of all things, is completely beyond me. So what does this mean in practice? Just in the news the other day, there was a story about Micron appealing a $400 million verdict against it in East Texas. And the patent, you know, they were sued earlier, so they were still able to challenge the patent. There's a co-pending appeal of a PTAB decision saying these claims are invalid. This is the technical experts at the board looked at it and decided this was already known. There are plenty of other suits against Micron, mostly by NPEs, some by YMTC, a state-owned company. In the future, are we really going to cut off the ability of Micron and companies like that to protect itself against a patent that's not valid? And one final thing, there's this, a lot of this is premised on the notion that, oh, district court litigation is just as good a forum for testing these things. Like, since the 70s, we've shifted mainly to doing jury trials in these cases. Very few jurors have a technical background. Often very skilled trial lawyers will tell you not even to bother present a paper-based, a patents and printed publications obviousness defense to a jury. Juries are not going to engage on what was obvious in semiconductor design circa 2007. At best, they're inconsistent about it. And when you get repeated suits, you will have invalid patents enforced for very high amounts. And I hope the administration really thinks about this. Like, how many hits do you want companies like Micron or our semiconductors and others to take for hundreds of millions, sometimes billions of dollars for a patent that if they were allowed to challenge it before the technical experts at the agency, they would agree that it's not valid. And I've talked to many people on the life sciences side who think, you know, we don't really need IPRs, et cetera. And the life sciences is different, okay? The quality is higher there. It's mostly judge trials and, you know, via ANDA cases. But I always think back to a line from Bob Armitage, who was heavily involved in the AIA, was general counsel of Eli Lilly at the time. He warned people, if you like patents, if you love patents, do you love your children? You know, most people love their children too. If your children are misbehaving, don't you want to correct their behavior? And the folks out there who love patents, if you see the system being abused, if it's seeing, you know, if you see a patents misbehaving in effect, you want to correct that behavior because you'll be the most gentle disciplinarian, and the backlash that's going to come if we allow things like this to go forward and literally just immunize patents that never should have issued and are being asserted by NPEs. We're doing severe damage to the integrity and legitimacy of the system with this NPRM. I very much hope the administration reconsiders this.
Well, thank you, Joseph. Before we get into the individual provisions, Joseph, you brought up misbehaving patents, and I guess the question I have is, did they misbehave before the AIA, or were they good children?
Before the AIA, you had inter-parties reexaminations, which actually had the same scope of challenge. The problem with inter-party, the reason the system was upgraded in the AIA was just the structure of inter-parties re-exams made them impossible to get done in a timely manner. They pretty routinely dragged out for 6 or 7 years. In fact, I believe there are still 2 or 3 inter-parties re-exams that are still pending, even though the deadline for filing them expired in 2012. These are cases, obviously, but a procedure that can be dragged out that long, that either party can kind of delay at will, is not useful as a check on validity when you have co-pending litigation. But the decision to go back to the agency goes back to 1980. you know, validity review has always been available in courts, but, you know, over the course of the 20th century, Congress heard enough complaints about this that decided, you know, we really need technical experts to be able to look at this. And in the 80s, they created ex parte re-exam. Then they decided, you know, you really need both parties to be able to participate. And then added inter parties re-exam, but inter parties re-exam just became dysfunctional. You know, the point of the AI wasn't just to make it, you know, faster and quicker, but it's that original idea that, especially for these complex technologies, you're not going to get an accurate and reliable decision on validity other than from technical experts.
Okay. So Andre, David and Joseph have pointed to a lot of flaws that they see in the NPRM. And Joseph points out misbehaving patents, which I think might be better characterized as misbehaving litigants in the courts. But can you maybe address some of the flaws that have been pointed out? And you know, you highlighted the motivation for the NPRM. I don't think people may disagree with the motivation, but can you maybe take on some of those flaws and tell us whether they're right or wrong?
Well, look, first of all, I do want to emphasize that this is exactly the process that's supposed to take place in a notice and comment rulemaking exercise. Folks who have different points of view, make them known, and then the administration will consider them all. So I hope folks that across the various interests here do that. And I think that will result in a better rule package at the end of the day. But we have to be careful with the language that we're using here and try to stay away from hyperbole. So let me just address a couple of the points that have been raised. Just on a factual basis, David, you mentioned that the NPRM forecloses IPRs based on non-final decisions, and you're right in the reading of the proposed rule, which is, you know, if there is a summary judgment ruling or a jury verdict, the estoppel effectively applies at that point, when there are such rulings from the district courts that find the patent not invalid. And your point was, well, all those can be reversed on appeal. Okay, but let's just think through the alternatives here. The district court in those examples found the patent not invalid. If it goes on appeal, two possible outcomes, theoretically, obviously there are many others, but just theoretically, either the Federal Circuit affirms what was just found, and therefore the patent is still not invalid. And in that case, there's no reason not to attach the estoppel at the earlier point in time. Why wait another year and a half? On the other hand, if the Federal Circuit finds the patent invalid, then the patent's gone and everything goes away, including the litigation and the patent completely. You don't need, at that point, if the Federal Circuit speaks and the Federal Circuit has found the patent invalid, you no longer need an IPR process, obviously, at that point in time. So in either circumstance, from that pure technical perspective, I don't think that's that is necessarily a reason to find meaningful fault here. Now, you can argue on the other point that Mr. Jones has made, which is, the pure one and done type of an approach, which is, and I think Joe made the same point, which is, look, why should the results coming from a different litigation prosecuted by a different party, completely unrelated and at a long distance in time, and perhaps over different accused products, et cetera, why should that preclude others? And I have to say, that is a fair debate. And there are policy reasons to go either way, but it is a fair debate. But one thing I will say, and again, to avoid hyperbole here, it's not that if you go and you accept the NPRM's approach to that policy, if that's what comes out, it doesn't mean that the world has collapsed and defendants have no way to challenge the validity of a patent anymore. And then that's it. Billions of dollars will be, forever at risk without recourse. The defendants can still defend themselves, obviously, in the district court litigation or the ITC litigation, just as they have been from the beginning of the patent system. They can still go to the patent office if they want and do ex parte reexaminations. That is still a viable approach. I am not saying that that is the correct policy position. I acknowledge that there are legitimate debates on both sides. And I don't need to repeat, but David and Joe have made the policy argument why that would not be fair to the particular litigant in this particular case. On the other side, one can argue, the patent owners might argue, well, look, you need quiet title, and the PTO has already, an adjudicative body has already looked at the validity of this thing. And a patent is an objective document, and once the judiciary in whatever format has passed on it, then why should the judiciary look at it again? Now, I really do understand the practical considerations that nothing is purely objective in this world, and claim constructions can be different. The scope of claims can be interpreted differently based on the infringement allegations in a particular case and all of that. But my only point is that that is a fair debate, and we should avoid the extreme hyperbole on both sides. One final point to go to address one point that Joe made. Joe, you fundamentally seem to reject the role of juries, at least on the validity analysis, but. Look, the reality is the jury system is fundamental to the American judicial process. It's in our Constitution. It's there in it's there twice. It's in the body and in the amendments, to be frank. And it's been a core part of our system of laws from the beginning of time. And if you don't trust the jury system, then we have bigger problems with our judicial system than patent validity challenges. I'll say this. I think it's a fair debate, that you're pointing out. Are juries technically equipped or not to hear patent cases? And countries around the world have had that debate, and we are still here in the United States on the side of jury trials. Other countries do not have them. But when it comes to the validity question, if you do not like the jury, you don't trust the juries, or a particular defendant does not trust juries, then that defendant can go and do an IPR, but just do the IPR then. The biggest problem that I've had was with the insistence on both. And if one of your clients, Joe, says, look, I agree with you. I don't think a jury is capable to understand my complicated technology here. And from a validity point of view, I don't think we should give it to the jury. So let's give it to the PTAB. But in that case, why also maintain the parallel ability to do the jury as well? And, this hasn't come up yet here in this discussion, but, there is the Prevail bill out there. And that's what that bill tries to accomplish is like, okay, each defendant can pick, and it's the choice of the defendant, and you pick one. You pick the jury or the court system, or you pick the PTAB system, but not both. So you've got to pick, you know, the concept in general here is pick the horse you're going to ride, but don't do it. Don't do both. And that goes a little bit beyond this NPRM, because this NPRM has other issues beyond just picking one or the other for one particular defendant. But conceptually, I think that's a debate, that's an issue worth discussing and resolving, frankly.
Thank you, Andre. Dave, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to various things that Andre has said. But Joe, first, I want to give you the opportunity to respond to being criticized about not liking juries.
Okay. Well, look, Andre, the system you're describing, you know, where you're forced to choose, it's colorably reasonable. We could have that debate. You're basically describing the system you left in place when you left the agency. That is not what the NPRM does. Under the NPRM, literally, again, like someone else was sued 10 years earlier and couldn't bring a challenge, brought an unsuccessful challenge. Now you can't bring a challenge, and doing a Sotera stipulation, et cetera, isn't going to overcome the rules that they put in place here. They seem to not even have the stipulation in the parallel proceedings provision. You literally will, you know, it doesn't matter what the case is. Someone else was sued earlier, or you're sued in a fast-moving district, and you cannot go to an inter partes proceeding before the agency. And it's great that everyone loves juries. Juries are good at a lot of things. They can tell when people are lying. But again, your typical juror does not have a technical background. In the few cases where people present these defenses and they're able to interview the jurors later, they routinely discover the jury deliberations were a disaster. The jury did not engage at all with the technology. Look, a lot of this stuff is just very complex, and having the technical background to at least understand the prior art is a critical element to being able to accurately and reliably assess whether this was obvious or not. You know, jurors tend to be motivated by things like narratives. When you watch the way really good trial lawyers prepare for this, it's all about our narratives and our themes, and it's not about are the limitations of the claim met by the prior art. And again, this is we've had you know. The Supreme Court started talking about the need for technical experts in patent cases going back to the 19th century. Learned and denounced how ridiculous it is that he as a judge had to learn this stuff, and that we needed some system like this. It was a long debate building up to the creation of these post-issuance proceedings. And, you know, it's pretty clear what's going to happen if you cut these off. You're going to immunize invalid patents and make it impossible to effectively challenge them. And again, like how many multi-$100 million hits do we want Micron Technology or chip makers to make? These are big companies, but that's money they could spend on R&D. And I'll tell you, some of these very companies have expressed in our private discussions that this is existential for them. If they don't have access to some way to challenge these cases and the NPE suits they're facing in Texas, it will eventually run them out of business. So I just hope that administration, someone talks sense into the people up there. J.D. Vance has said all these very intelligent things about manufacturing, how you can't give up the ability to make things. You're eventually going to be impoverished if you forget how to make things. A lot of innovation just comes out of the process of mastering the manufacturing. If we let companies like Micron be run out of business or hobbled, you know, our manufacturing strategy is get your DRAM memories from China. That's the administration's manufacturing strategy if they go forward with some of the ridiculous things in this NPRM.
Okay. I mean, look, again, I really think we should avoid hyperbole here. Just because you have to litigate a patent in court or at the ITC or through ex parte re-exam, just because this one tool is unavailable in a particular case doesn't mean that the United States manufacturing infrastructure collapses. I'm not debating whether you like the NPRM or not. There are definitely points to be discussed. But again, I think we're going to lose perspective on creating a better system if we engage in this type of hyperbole. But on the jury point, I just want to ask you, Joe, a direct question. accepting hypothetically what you just said, that juries are not capable of doing that. And, you know, some cases are definitely technology is more complicated. And in that particular case, you really don't think the jury can do it. And you want the experts of the PTAB to do that validity challenge. Do you agree then that in that case, you should not also maintain the ability to go to that jury that you just articulated is not reliable?
You know, that's not what the statute says, but it's a fair compromise. Frankly, I think if a review has been instituted, if the board's already found there's a reasonable likelihood the claims are invalid, then you should stay the trial. There's an excellent chance at that point that some or all of the claims will be canceled once you've met that institution threshold. And going through a trial is frankly a waste of everyone's money. Typically, when these dual litigations have to go forward that patent owners complain about, it's not the defendant who wanted the litigation to go forward, it's the plaintiff who wanted the litigation to go forward. Typically, and from what I've seen, if both the defendant and the plaintiff ask for a stay of the case pending the completion of the review, the judge will grant it. And look, I'm not saying this is, you do get cases where the technology is very accessible and where, an ordinary person can assess, would have this been an obvious or not. But in some of these cases, it's just invaluable to have that technical expert. And at the very least, you're not going to get a reliable result. And when these companies are facing repeated litigation, again, like these numbers are in the papers. These are multi-hundred million, even billion-dollar awards. Do we want to take that kind of money out of these companies' hides? Money that could be spent on building another auto plant or a chip fab. It seems like a no-brainer to me that we want an accurate and reliable assessment of validity before we shift that kind of money around.
Okay, Dave, I promise I will get to you because I'm sure there's a lot you'd like to say about this conversation. But Brian, I'd really like to bring you in. In light of the time, excuse me, I'd like to try to address each of the provisions of the NPRM separately. So the first provision is the required stipulation. And it says, quote, inter-party review shall not be instituted or maintained unless each petitioner files a stipulation with the board and any other tribunal where it is litigating or later litigates regarding the challenge patent, stating that if a trial is instituted, the petitioner and any real party in interest or privy of the petitioner will not raise grounds of invalidity or unpatentability with respect to the challenge patents under 102 or 103 in any other proceeding. Brian, can you tell us whatever benefits or flaws you see in that provision?
Well, I think the benefits are obvious in the sense that, okay, we're going to actually choose a tribunal and we're going to abide by the decision of that tribunal. So whichever way it goes and whatever the parties decide, it makes sense rather than having two duplicative proceedings that, by the way, are decided according to different burdens of proof and different standards. So we can have competing decisions that come out of the Article III courts and decisions that come out of the PTO tribunal that are in conflict but are both correct. And that just doesn't make any sense from a jurisprudential efficiency standpoint. And I think, to comment on Joe's remarks about the professional and technological expertise within the patent office relative to that of a jury, I'm a little bit skeptical of the notion that just because we have technical experts in the PTO that they're necessarily going to always come to the right conclusion. The fact of the matter is we have an issued patent that the PTO has determined is patentable, and then it goes back into the same agency before substantially the same technical experts who come to the opposite conclusion. That just doesn't seem to be efficient from the standpoint of investment and innovation and giving people the opportunity to move forward. So I'm also troubled by sort of the one-way stare decisis that exists under the IPR system. The serial challenges that take place on substantially the same arguments means that the patent owner is perpetually in jeopardy and never really gets out from underneath that, whereas they would in a court proceeding. But we don't have anything that stops the serial challenges that are in place right now. So I think, somebody ought to get to choose a tribunal, and then that really should be effectively the end point. But we don't have that. And so consequently, we have duplicative litigation. We have duplicative IPRs. And it's just not efficient, and it's not fair and reasonable for the patent owners. And it certainly doesn't promote innovation.
I'll tell you what, Brian, I'll trade you one and done on the IPR side for one and done on the litigation side. Patent owners can only bring one case, preferably just against one defendant, and then they're done forever. And they can't sue anybody else. And then we can have one and done on the IPR side. I'd be happy to make that deal.
But they are, Dave. I mean, if you bring a patent suit and the defendant proves that the patent's invalid, they're done. They've shot their chance, and they're not going to get to come back and bring that up again. If they win, that's a different story. And by the way, usually they're arguing about infringement at that point. Now, certainly the defendant at that point can again raise substantially the same arguments of invalidity. But presumably the judge will be at least moderately persuaded by the arguments that were raised in an earlier proceeding. So I think that exists, Dave.
I'm not so sure, but I won't argue the point. I would like to get back to kind of Andre's point about exaggeration, because I'm a big exaggerator, but it is no exaggeration to say it's not just that billions would be at risk in judgments. I mean, you look at the litigation record of the companies I represent, they do pretty well in litigation. They did pretty well in litigation prior to the AIA, but not always, right? You do have a lot of uncertainty with juries. But it will be billions of dollars just in litigation costs that will be added here. I mean, easily billions. I mean, there was a study pre-AIA that found that just I think PAE suits resulted in something like a $32 billion loss to the U.S. economy. And to Andre's point about exaggeration, it's not necessarily exaggeration. I don't know what's going to happen. But this look is going to look a lot like pre-AIA days. And that looked pretty ugly. And yeah, companies really do leave countries because of kind of litigation risk. When I was at Microsoft, during the Motorola case, we'd been telling the kind of German government for years, the liability under the patent laws is getting out of control. You're going to start driving business away. During the Motorola litigation, Microsoft announced that it was moving its European distribution center out of Germany. And we got a call a day or two later from the German government. Said, that's a lot of jobs and a lot of tax revenue. I'm like, what can we do? I said, well, you can listen to us like 2 years ago. Now the decision's made and we're leaving. So it really does. I mean, I can point to a number of practical experiences where people have made fairly large corporate decisions and sometimes to leave the entire jurisdiction just because of the liability, because you have other options, right? And so if the United States is slightly better rather than a lot better as a site for your manufacturing plant, well, that extra, $100 million, $200, $300 million can tip the balance. It really can have an effect.
I would say one of the things that's more mobile than companies and moving in response to litigation or legal developments is investment. And if investors know that they're not going to get the return on their investment because of a weak patent system, they're going to invest in companies elsewhere. And we've already seen that happen. And so what we want to do is we want to invest in disruptive technologies here in the United States. And so we need to protect innovators and we need to protect patent holders.
But Brian, that just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, most VCs are investing in companies they expect to operate in multiple countries. So you'd have to have the same defects in every country for that to make any sense, right? And then if you have the same defects in the patent systems of every country enough to like reduce incentives, well, there'd be no point to moving. And if you're in an international company, there is already no point to moving, because under TRIPS, you can face the same, when you're located in China and you apply for a U.S. patent, you're going to face the same defects. And, when you're a U.S. company, you're almost always going to apply for a patent in China. So it doesn't make sense to me that anyone would, there's no reason under TRIPS for anyone ever to change their residence because of patent laws.
Well, David, I mean, that may be true for the large multinationals you represent, but it's not true of the startups, the original entrepreneurs and the like. And you know, a lot of American innovation happens in the startup economy, obviously across the spectrum. And usually you look to your domestic market first. You know, if you're an American startup, your first instance is I'm looking to develop and market my product here in the United States. And if I'm successful, then I'll go to Europe maybe. And then if I'm successful, I'll go to China in time and so on and so forth. But first and foremost, I need my domestic market and I need to protect that domestic market, because if I don't have that, by the time I get to Europe, I won't ever get to Europe or to China. It's going to be too late. The product will be killed and the company will be killed in its infancy. Obviously, when the companies are mature and they're multinationals, conglomerates, and all of that, the calculus, all of this calculus, is a little bit different. I also want to go back to, again, I'm just the whole conversation is you know the unfortunate. I'm concerned that the whole conversation surrounding this is devolving into hyperbole, and it's going to prevent good policy to be made. And good policy always results from conversation, discussions, and compromise. I already heard through the various statements a proposed compromise from Joe. But if we're just sticking at the extremes on both sides, we're not going to be able to have the rational conversation where it needs to be in the middle. So, you know, statements like, for example, you know, you may have been kidding, Dave, I don't know, but statements like you'll trade one and done in the IPR system with one and done for infringement just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. It's not like it's one and done for invalidity, period. Every defendant, no matter what, will have the ability to defend himself in court for sure, just like the plaintiff has an opportunity to present the plaintiff's case in court in every single case. This doesn't impact the court cases at all. So you still have the defense there. So you can't just, you know, because you're preventing one PTO mechanism, now you're preventing the entire court system on the other side. And by the way, you're not even preventing the entire PTO mechanisms. You still have the ex parte in place. So my only point is, you know, it's fine to debate whether one and done to the world is good policy or not. It's fine to have that debate. But I would just simply stay away from these extreme hyperboles that divert from a potential result that results in a balanced system. So, for example, and I asked Joe this, and I will ask you as well. Are you okay with a system that is not one and done to the world, but it's one and done as to a particular defendant? Or, short of that, one and done as to a particular proceeding? There's various gradations here. So my only hope is that if people don't like the NPRM, and again, I emphasize, you know, there's legitimate arguments on both sides of all of these points in the NPRM. If you don't like them, make a counter proposal that reaches a result that we don't have. On the one hand, you don't like the one and done to the world, but on the other hand, we also shouldn't have, you know, endless repetitive challenges between the same parties on the same patent with the same arguments. There's lots of place in the middle that people can have a rational debate and reach a rational conclusion.
So here's a compromise for you. I don't think you're going to like it, but one way to address some of the issues that Joe and I are raising would be to have something like a working requirement. So you don't get the benefit of a discretionary denial unless you're actually practicing the patent in the United States. That protects investment in the United States. It actually gives you additional incentive because, you know, you get that benefit if you're working the patent. It protects small entities. You know, you can structure it however you want, you know, in terms of the entity making substantial efforts to practice. It doesn't mean that they have to be a going concern. That would exclude foreign companies that own U.S. patents but don't practice the United States from getting the benefit. I mean, something like that. The benefit of a discretionary denial. So no discretionary denial unless you're working the patent in the United States. That takes care of a huge portion of the PAE problem that concerns tech. I don't see how it gores the ox of, you know, if it's written properly, of people, kind of patentees who are actually intending or are already in business in the United States. But that would seem to satisfy kind of the concerns on both sides.
Ryan, would you like to address that?
Yeah, I would say it's a rather superficial look at how the patent system is actually used in practice. Not everybody patents things that they're going to turn into a product. Sometimes they're patenting it to license it or monetize it in some other way. Sometimes they're using it to maintain a particular market in a particular technology that is something other than what they've patented. So there are lots of different ways that people use the patent system. And I think history has shown that we have long since refused to put in place a working requirement. And I think the wisdom of that is self-evident.
Well, let me get back to Andre's point about, resisting hyperbole and trying to reach compromise, through thoughtful processes. I mean, it's a given that, we all approach the U.S. patent system with good faith, in the best for the system and the best for the country. But here's a question. If both sides of the issues regarding IPRs or patent law reform believe that their view of how to achieve the U.S. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, the Constitution goal to promote progress of science and useful arts and maintain fidelity with it is correct, how is that reconcilable? Can both views be right, or does it vary based on what the progress of science and useful arts has become? Or is it merely one side is right and the other side is wrong? Joe, would you like to tackle that?
I'll pass on the broader philosophical stuff. I mean, everyone has their different view. When you're talking to people in different industries, they just have completely different views of these issues. And frankly, the life sciences litigation is just so radically different, from what goes on in the tech space. It's not even the same, patent system. If we're going to talk about history, I came across something interesting recently. When he was Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson got into a back and forth discussion with a congressman about legislation they were considering. And the congressman had proposed, hey, shouldn't we have a rule that once patent validity has been decided once in a case, that should be the end of it? And Jefferson replied, if you do that, people will immediately have a collusive suit brought against them just to cut off future challengers. So this is this idea, the one and done philosophy, is one that Thomas Jefferson, one of the architects of the first patent act, rejected. Certainly the members of the Federalist Society should pay some heed when even Thomas Jefferson considered this and told you it's a terrible idea.
Well,
hold.
Go ahead.
Okay. Just for the record, Thomas Jefferson was not discussing the America Invents Act or the IPR system or the existing multiple parallel challenges at the same time on the same patent between the same parties. Again, let's just be grounded here. Look, the reality is the patent system from the beginning of time is a compromise. It's always a compromise between the rights of the innovator to protect the invention and his rights for a limited period of time versus the right of the public towards access towards that innovation. And everything comes down from that quid pro quo and compromise. And there's a push and pull. And our system for the last few decades has been harmed, in my opinion, by extreme views or one side on the other. The patent system and any system of property depends on long-term stability. Patents and other IP rights enable investment in long-term disruptive and risky technologies. People who make use of the system and then invest heavily in the innovation economy have to have a long-term view. And these radical moves from one side to the other, in increasingly fast at an increasingly fast pace is very disruptive to our innovation economy, and long term is going to put the United States at a competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis the rest of the world. This is why it's really important that we try to get the sides together and have a rational conversation to reach long-term stability. And look, bottom line is, and I've said this for a long time, I prefer a legislative solution in general to enable long-term stability. We haven't talked in detail about Prevail, but that could be this conversation for a different such panel. The office, in the meantime, until there is a legislative solution, has to operate the system that's been given to it. And, you know, this is the NPRM is an attempt to operate the system in their view through notice and comment and get the public input. And if this is not the way it's going to go forward, it's going to be amended. Let's have the rational points be brought forward and fix the NPRM as the consensus comes out to be.
Unfortunately, Andrew, I think the office has put itself in a position where that's probably not possible. I mean, they're not following the regulations that were promulgated before. There's nothing in here that cuts off discretion. You know, based on the Federal Circuit decisions, it's unlikely that you can get mandamus, an APA suit, and certainly can't get a direct appeal of any of these decisions. So, I mean, I fear that you're going to have people on my side who look at the regulations and say, you know, why would I believe that they will actually be followed? What possible relevance do they have? Why should I spend a lot of time trying to negotiate something that I don't believe will be binding? I don't mean to pass this person's on the office. I'm just saying the sentiment on my side, you know, where we, and you know me, Andre, we have sat down and had these conversations. You know, normally we'd be happy to, but in this circumstance, I can't tell my member companies that, yes, the PTO is going to abide by these regs, whatever we negotiate. There will be no certainty at all. They're not, like I said, they're not abiding by the regs that were promulgated previously.
Well, getting back to Andre's point about, legislation. If Congress, I mean, in order to achieve stability and, you know, the finality issue that we're all talking about as well in terms of determinations, would it make more sense for Congress to really take the bull by the horn, so to speak, and deal with these issues directly? I would suggest that I've come up with an acronym, Epstein, which would probably make it sail through quite quickly. But I'll ask each of you to just briefly say whether you think that a congressional response to these issues and what's, you know, the Prevail Act, for instance, is a better course of action to avoid whiplash from administration to administration at the agency. Brian, I'll ask you first.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. I agree 100% with what Andre said. Legislation is the only way to fix this. These are invariably long-term investments. They're tricky, risky investments. Patent system, a reliable, predictable patent system is central to that. And to get back to your earlier question, you know, since the very beginning of this nation, we wrote into our Constitution the provision for the Patent Act. Everybody wants innovation. Doesn't matter what side of the coin you're on, everybody wants innovation. But the fact of the matter is we created with our Constitution the first patent act of its kind that had not existed anywhere else in the world, with certain limitations that the rights would go only to the inventor for limited times and their exclusive rights only. And as a result, we have become the most innovative nation the world has ever seen. And that's because of our legal regime. It's not something in the water here in the United States. It's because we have a predictable, reliable legal regime that protects innovators. And so I agree with Andre that, you know, we have to find the middle ground. legislation is a tool of compromise. But I do believe legislation is the only way to fix this, because otherwise we're going to be attacking port and starboard for many years to come as each administration changes and we get different people coming in with different ideas. So legislation is absolutely imperative.
Joe, your feelings on having Congress correct these issues?
Sure. You know, one interesting thing is, you know, we now have a dozen years experience under the American Defense Act and PTAP proceedings. And one thing we know for certain, despite all the attacks on the proceeding from within and without the agency, is the proceedings actually work quite well. They work more or less as intended. The board is producing high quality decisions. Those decisions are upheld on appeal more often than district court decisions are, even though they're more reviewable because they're actually explained. To the extent people have detected bias in the board's decisions and the Federal Circuit's reversals, it's been a bias in favor of patent owners. The board is much more likely to be reversed for having failed to find claims unpatentable than to be reversed for finding them unpatentable. I'd say there's a good case to be made that at this point, more of these issues should be shifted from the board and out of court, that a broader set of issues should be allowed to be raised in inter-parties reviews or later in the life of the patent. PGR is great, but it can only be brought in the first 9 months, and you can't challenge every patent in your, you know, in your art field. Most people aren't going to have that budget. The problem is, though, like, legislation takes years, and it was about a 10-dozen year process for the AIA. And right now, we're facing this reg that is literally going to cut off the ability to challenge validity on improperly issued patents in hundreds of cases. If the administration goes through with this reg, you're going to see American manufacturers get ripped off on a massive scale. Again, we know these proceedings are the only reliable and consistent system for reviewing these things. Why on earth the administration is doing this, I frankly have no idea. It completely undercuts everything that the higher level officials have said about the importance of strengthening and reinforcing manufacturing capacity in the United States.
Okay, well, I see we're kind of run over time, but to Andrea's point, I think it would be very beneficial if we could reconvene this group and talk about Prevail, if everyone is in agreement to that. I don't run the show, but I'll certainly make that suggestion, and I think it can happen. I want to thank each one of you for all of your thoughtful comments and this discussion. Hopefully, we've all learned a little something. I believe, as Andre points out, the best way to understand your own position is really to understand the position of the person who disagrees with you, and then hopefully you can reach that compromise. Any last one-word thoughts before we end?
Legislation, yes, but not necessarily to fix the PTAB. I think we might need a new solution.
Anyone else? Okay, I guess we're at it. Thank you again. I thoroughly appreciated this this conversation.
Thanks, all. Good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Andre, Joseph, David, and Brian for speaking with us today, and for Rob for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date on other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, vetsoc.org, or all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.